This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, two gigantic Trump stories were slated to occur simultaneously on opposite sides of the globe, both fundamentally about our president, though in one case in absentia, and both so keenly anticipated that many media watchers predicted that cable news would have to present them on a split screen.
The event in Hanoi with the president incarnate was his second meeting with Supreme Leader Kim Jong-un. Last year, they captured the world's attention with Trump's charm offensive in Singapore. This year, he sought to recapture some of that magic and to finish what he never actually started, taking a big step towards North Korea's denuclearization. It was a big fizzle on both counts.
That's right. It's over. And there was no deal to curb North Korea's nuclear weapons program.
This time we decided not to do any of the options, and we'll see where that goes.
Some say the deal failed because Trump was woefully, willfully unprepared. As for the magic, it was gone. Not that the audience doesn't enjoy some improv or a high wire act, but there's much less appetite for reruns. And there was a hot ticket live show right here at home. Michael Cohen, Trump's former personal lawyer, in an all-day engagement before the House Oversight Committee.
The fact-checkers and the news analysts have had their way with it, but the drama worked its way into the amygdala and hippocampus of every viewer who thrilled or quailed or mostly cringed at the spectacle but found it hard to turn away. It was monotonous sometimes, since some committee members were reading from the same page, but it was gripping, and it was also familiar. A popular genre, a procedural, with a dash of movie mob melodrama thrown in. The organized crime type of language has kind of been a theme throughout this presidency.
I know all about flipping. For 30, 40 years, I've been watching flippers. Everything's wonderful, and then they get 10 years in jail, and they flip on whoever the next highest one is.
And then there's Michael Cohen talking about threatening people on Wednesday.
How many times did Mr. Trump ask you to threaten an individual or entity on his behalf?
Quite a few times.
50 times?
More.
100 times?
More.
200 times?
More.
500 times?
Probably.
And a lot of people have made this observation. Nicholas Pileggi, who penned screenplays for Goodfellas and Casino. He told the New York Times that it rang such a bell with him that Trump was surrounded by these people. Being raised in that environment, it was normalized to him.
At the same time, I was actively negotiating in Russia for him. He would look me in the eye and tell me there's no Russian business.
I do take your point about mob movies. When Cohen was testifying on Wednesday about how Trump would tell him how to testify without actually telling him how to testify.
He doesn't give you questions. He doesn't give you orders. He speaks in a code. And I understand the code because I've been around him for a decade.
That sounded familiar.
Did you ever get such an order directly from Michael Corleone?
No, I never talked to him.
It was so Willy Cheechy, the Corleone family soldier who in Godfather Part II was testifying before what looked very much like the Kefauver Committee on Organized Crime.
Mr. Cheechy, could you amplify your answer a bit, please?
Do what?
Was there always a buffer involved? Is someone in between you and your possible superiors who gave the actual order?
Right, yeah, buffer. The family had a lot of buffers.
Yeah. Interesting side note, Bob. The Kefauver hearings were televised live back in 1951, and they were a blockbuster. I was reading about them. Women, they said, neglected their housework. 30 million people tuned in.
At New York's federal building, alleged overlord of gambling, Frank Costello, arrives to face the senatorial gambling probe. Frank Erickson, convicted bookmaker, is also on hand.
And then later that year, Americans chose the committee chairman, C. Estes Kefauver, who was a first-time Tennessee Democrat, as one of the 10 most admired men, right up there with the Pope and Albert Einstein.
The crime investigating committee, headed by Senator Estes Kefauver, left, swept into New York, uncovering hidden criminal activities. This was a house cleaning that lifted the rugs, indeed.
So, organized crime, yes, the echoes were everywhere, but I also heard some other Hollywood echoes. There was even some Woody Allen. When the Republican Jody Heiss said,
"And it's a shameful mockery of what our purpose is."
And Mark Green of Tennessee said,
"His presence here is a travesty."
I'm like, this is bananas. Literally, Brooke, the courtroom scene from the movie, bananas.
It's a travesty of a mockery of a sham, of a mockery of a travesty of two mockeries of a sham.
But look, what really struck me on Wednesday had nothing to do with courtroom dramas or farces. What struck me was Dickens.
What?
Okay, bear with me. Here was Cohen in his opening statement.
"I am ashamed of my weakness and my misplaced loyalty, of the things I did for Mr. Trump in an effort to protect and promote him. I am ashamed that I chose to take part in concealing Mr. Trump's illicit acts rather than listening to my own conscience."
That was nominally an apology, but as the day progressed, I think it took on a new cast. When Tennessee Republican Jim Cooper asked Cohen why, after so many years, he decided to turn on the president, Cohen restated that apology more as a warning to the president's "see no evil" supporters, a raid on the dais in front of him.
Were they on a dais?
Yeah, it was elevated.
Okay.
"I did the same thing that you're doing now. And I can only warn people, the more people that follow Mr. Trump, as I did blindly, are going to suffer the same consequences that I'm suffering."
It was like, this is your future. It was right out of A Christmas Carol. Cohen was, you know, the ghostly Jacob Marley, and the Republicans were Scrooge.
"I am here to warn you, to save you, if that be possible."
"From what?"
"From such a fate as mine."
"But you were always a good man of business, Jacob. Business.
Mankind should have been my business. Charity, forbearance, benevolence, all were my business, as they should be yours."
Soon after his must-see testimony, Michael Cohen confirmed that he would return to the House for another round of questioning on March 6th. Meanwhile, quietly in the background, special counsel Robert Mueller pursues his two-pronged investigation into whether the president, his family, or his aides colluded with Russia to help him win, and whether they've interfered with any investigations into election-related activity. Overwhelming and extremely difficult to parse, filled with misfires, false alarms, and intoxicating intrigue, the press have turned the saga of Mueller's secret investigation into the best, worst crime drama never written. To date, the press have reported on nearly 150 characters in the Mueller probe, including politicians, investigators, policemen, petty criminals, offspring, and erstwhile Trump aides, all potential clues with potential roles in the special counsel's forthcoming final report. And so, to help you make sense of the rumors and revelations to come, we bring you the latest of our breaking news consumer's handbooks, the Mueller edition. Eric Umansky is a deputy managing editor at ProPublica and a co-host of Trump, Inc., a podcast produced by ProPublica and WNYC. Eric, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So start by taking a look at some of the reporting on Mueller that's led us astray.
Remember, big picture, we all knew Paul Manafort had long and extensive links to the Russian government-affiliated oligarchs. What is new tonight is this reported meeting with that other group you don't want to have contact with, WikiLeaks, specifically its leader, Julian Assange.
This was first reported by The Guardian in November of 2018, and The Guardian has never retracted the story. Other outlets picked it up. Why should we question its veracity?
I put that story into the category of the permanent exclusive. An exclusive is a wonderful thing to have. You get the information before everybody else. Mm. Then what you want is for other people to conclude the same thing.
Now, other people picked it up.
Right, but here's a key distinction. If another place is picking it up, if they're just crediting the Guardian reports X, well, that doesn't mean that they have corroborated it.
Which brings us to another bombshell.
President Trump is facing new scrutiny today over a report that he told his personal attorney to lie to Congress about his business dealings with Russia. That is, according to a BuzzFeed News report citing sources in the Southern District of New York.
What was really explosive about the BuzzFeed article was, according to two sources, Michael Cohen has given the goods in some fashion or another to federal prosecutors. Has BuzzFeed seen the evidence? Not at all clear. Some people at the special prosecutor's office may well have told BuzzFeed reporters something. I can't imagine that the BuzzFeed reporters are lying about that. That doesn't mean that it is actually true or that the evidence exists for it.
The special counsel spokesperson, Peter Carr, said that BuzzFeed's description of specific statements and characterizations of documents and testimony were not accurate. Does Michael Cohen's testimony Wednesday change that for you at all?
Michael Cohen said, on the one hand, I was never instructed by the president to lie. On the other hand, he made it very, very clear to me what he wanted by constantly asking about the business in Russia, about their tower deal, while literally saying, you know, Michael, there's no tower deal.
In a way, the BuzzFeed story may be wrong in the details, but right in its conclusion?
Yes, it is a quantum physics scoop. It is both simultaneously right and wrong.
I think at this point, it'd be useful to define our terms for anybody who's been reading this coverage and will in the future. Links to Russia. That's a phrase we just talked about. But there are 50 shades of collusion, right?
Yeah. In fact, links to Russia, whenever I see that kind of thing, it means almost nothing to me.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It is so vague.
I have links to Russia. I reported there for 3 years.
As does my family when they were in the shtetl. The U.S. has a long, glorious history, as do most countries, of foreign boogeymen. Currently, Russia is in that spot with plenty of evidence suggesting it should be. But again, it's not a shortcut for diligence. The collusion versus conflicts of interest, I think, is crucial and I think is not appreciated enough. There's lots of stuff that's deeply problematic mm-hmm. before collusion. Just take what we know. The presidential candidate was working on a deal in another country, secretly, that he later lied about, that his colleagues lied about, under oath. Why is that problematic? Well, you know, Trump's operating in his own interest, which turns out, as it happens, potentially to be foreign adversary of the United States' interests.
There are those who would have you believe that the Mueller investigation is a big sham. Many of the president's party in the Senate, the president himself, and of course, many of his allies in the media. So let's listen to some of the language they used to discredit the indictments of former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn and political operative Roger Stone.
And his indictment is not even for a violent crime. It has nothing to do with Russia or collusion. It's a process crime. You keep asking the same questions over and over and over, hoping there'll be a mistake. And when there is, you indict.
Can't get him on an actual crime, so the old perjury trap always becomes the fallback in the Mueller camp of Democratic donors.
Now, what do they mean by process crimes? You now have the president's former campaign manager, the president's national security advisor, the president's former lawyer. All busted for lying. So I guess you could take the perspective that, gee, all they're being busted for is lying. Okay. Nobody has been charged with active collusion. The other way to think about that is, wait a second, why are all these guys lying?
Obstruction and cover-ups were how they got Al Capone, President Nixon. There's no end to people who are apprehended on obstruction. Because it's easier. It's low-hanging fruit. What they're really after is the tree.
And it raises substantive questions. I mean, you don't lie to prosecutors, you don't lie to Congress. It's a really bad idea, right? And it's illegal. So I guess you could dismiss all of that, or you can say, well, gee, that's really worthy of further digging into why they did it.
So Mueller means many things to different people. To many people, Mueller represents a deus ex machina, a way to get us out of this mess.
And this may be a bummer for people, but when they think, when is the Mueller report going to come, they're really thinking, like, when can I, like, open up my laptop and take a look at it? You may not be able to do that for a long, long time. It is not going to be made public initially. It goes to the Attorney General.
Attorney General Bill Barr.
Appointed by, nominated by President Trump.
There's a little history behind how special prosecutor reports can be released. And this really goes back to Ken Starr's investigation of Bill Clinton.
Right. So after that and all the salacious details that we were all fixated on, Congress felt a little bit icky about it, ultimately, and changed the law so that it doesn't necessarily become public in all glorious detail.
There's a highlight reel that goes to Congress. That's mandated, but it's the Attorney General who decides what those highlights are. And if Congress wants to get hold of the full report, I guess they have to subpoena it.
They could, and then we're in a whole fakakta legal battle about getting it.
So it's quite possible that those of us hanging on the Mueller report will never, ever see it.
And by the way, that's only the first tier of why Mueller should not be considered, as you said, the deus ex machina. Mueller's job isn't to look at everything.
He is just a piece in the Rube Goldberg investigative contraption that is now at work on Trump. Just a piece.
By the way, a lot of times you'll see in stories that say federal prosecutors in Manhattan, right? That is not the Mueller people. That is the Southern District of New York, who have their own multiple things they are looking into, including the inauguration. They're looking into Trump's businesses. Mm-hmm. It's a whole different group of folks.
You want to go through them?
So then, keeping with the New York theme, you have the New York Attorney General looking into the Trump Foundation. Then you have New York tax authorities and the question of evasion of taxes. There's the New York Times remarkable story.
President has always portrayed himself as a master businessman, using the art of the deal to turn a small loan into a global empire. But now a New York Times investigation claims he was actually given a fortune from his father's real estate company, often through, quote, dubious tax schemes.
Then you have the Manhattan DA looking into Manafort.
Former campaign manager.
Who is already likely to be staying in government's housing for free for the rest of his life, if you know what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
Then you move down the coast a little bit to Maryland and the District of Columbia. They have an emoluments lawsuit.
My personal favorite.
Just because you like the word emoluments?
I do.
The emoluments clause that bans foreign governments from giving free things to the president, right? And then the congressional investigations. Wednesday, Michael Cohen was speaking at the House Oversight Committee, but that is not the only committee digging into Trump. You have Judiciary, Ways and Means, and Intelligence. I'm sure I am missing others, and I'm sure there are others that are coming that we haven't gotten to yet.
We have to be skeptical when some people say Mueller's done.
Robert Mueller's report may land at literally at any minute. Now, whatever you think of all of this, things are getting very serious very quickly.
What's in it and how soon it comes out? All of that stuff is purely fueled by rumor, and anybody who's interested in the story really ought to know that by now.
Right.
I've always felt that there was too much coverage of the Mueller report. I think one of your points for news consumers is don't sweat the small stuff. Huge cast of characters, confusing plot lines. How can you possibly tell the difference between small-scale stuff and big-small stuff and enormous stuff? Other than by keeping up with everything.
there are lots of people paying attention to this. There are people who are paid to pay attention to it. We will synthesize all of this stuff. We will put together the big picture. You know, it's like following a little kid's train tracks that twist all in a million different ways, but still are going to end up at the door. And if you want to pick up the train at the end, just wait at the end.
Right. And thank you very much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Eric Umansky is a deputy managing editor with ProPublica and a co-host of the Trump Inc. podcast from ProPublica and WNYC Studios. And always, you can find our Breaking News Consumer's Handbook, Mueller Edition, at onthemedia.org.
Coming up, journalism is good, history is good, so together they must be perfect. Not necessarily.
This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, the House of Representatives voted to block President Trump's national emergency declaration for building a border wall. The latest step towards constitutional crisis, an impotent gesture in the face of gathering authoritarianism? Or was it, as some have concluded, just evidence that Trump, the strongman, has been a weakling all along?
The public doesn't appear to be with the president. A recent CNN poll found that 65% of Americans on average opposed the president's national emergency. He says he's fulfilling an election promise, but if he presses ahead with only 32% support for this national emergency, that could hurt him in 2020, couldn't it? Is this, do you think, a sign of weakness on President Trump's part?
I absolutely think it's a sign of weakness.
For those of us in the Trump is a threat to democracy community, sounding the alarms for 3 years about encroaching fascism, this trending notion of impotence sounds almost blasphemous. But it's also deeply rooted in historical analysis. So many, you know, citations and references and precedents. Has a better, more historically informed understanding of Trumpism changed the narrative? In a recent post for New York Magazine, political theorist Corey Robbins says, maybe, but beware of the historovox, a tendency to launder journalistic hot takes through history. He says that something goes missing when pundits look only backward.
What goes missing is captured really well by a famous quote from Orwell that says, to see what is in front of one's nose needs a constant struggle. And he said, one thing that helps toward it, that is, seeing in front of your nose, is to keep a diary, or at any rate, to keep some kind of record of one's opinions about important events. Otherwise, when some particularly absurd belief is exploded by events, one may simply forget that one ever held it. We all have a picture of the world, and in the age of the historovox, that picture of the world is provided to us by this nexus of journalists and academics. But that picture seems to change with a kind of an alarming rapidity, and we forget that not so long ago, we had a very different understanding of these things.
Now, there are different ways you can employ history, and one, obviously, is cherry-picking. You can advance almost any argument if you choose the historical events that seem to validate your premise and ignore the others that would argue against your premise. Do you see that happening, that sort of stacking the historical deck?
I think there's actually something even more pernicious, to be honest with you, than that. Let's take the last couple of years. There were all kinds of historical arguments that were advanced about Trump as a reprise of Mussolini and his fascism.
I think that Donald Trump's rhetoric of law and order is very Hitler-like.
And the problem, as I saw it, was not so much that people were cherry-picking from the past. It was the total indifference and lack of curiosity about what was happening, as Orwell said, right in front of your nose. For the first 2 years, when the Republicans completely controlled Congress, Trump sent up two budgets. He asked for things like cut off all funding for Planned Parenthood, $25 billion for the wall, billions of dollars more for hundreds of new enforcement officers in ICE. Those budgets were repeatedly rejected by a Republican-controlled Congress. The simplest definition of authoritarian is somebody who substitutes for the rule of law his will. And yet, Trump was singularly incapable of acting upon his will. So the problem here is not cherry-picking from the past. The problem is a composite picture from the past that's overlaid on the present that is indifferent to some pretty strong facts.
Now, one argument against Historovox is that it keeps kind of flip-flopping. Its take on executive power, for example, seems to shift between president and president. The analysis of the Obama administration, a little bit different than the Trump administration.
I think that's true. So during the Obama years, the predominant theory of the presidency was that it's an extraordinarily weak institution.
We have to admit that President Obama can't do much of a concrete plan without Congress getting on board in some fashion.
And that its weakness is best expressed in the impotence of presidential rhetoric. People say things like, oh, the president should use his bully pulpit. And if he says the right words, he can rally the Republic and get Congress to pass legislation that Congress doesn't want to pass. It's kind of the West Wing view of the presidency, you might say. And so a lot of political scientists and journalists spent 8 years of the Obama year saying, you know, this is just not the way the presidency works.
The conclusion was that presidential rhetoric, like hypnosis, can't make people do what they otherwise aren't going to do.
Correct. But then, oddly, Trump comes along, and it's almost the reverse. There has been this notion that, you know, Trump's tweets are going to turn the Republic into a raving hotbed of white nationalism with a racist majority marauding and rampaging throughout the country. Before, presidents were viewed as weak, and now they're viewed as extraordinarily potent, particularly in their rhetorical capacities. The question to me is not which view is right. I'm more struck by the whiplash, the speed at which one view is junked for another.
All right, Corey. Now, we have talked about journalistic practice, but I don't want to end this conversation before considering your own political analysis. The notion that Trump is, like most presidents, fundamentally weak, and that in his case, it's not just the weakness of the executive, but just him battling the other institutions and branches of government, even his own party. Now, if you'll forgive me for historovoxing myself, it seems to me that those are the very conditions that nourish authoritarianism historically, from the Roman Republic to Hitler, inciting zealous minorities and abusing democratic mechanisms to subvert democracy. So tell me again why we shouldn't be very, very worried about Trump as cornered rat?
There's no doubt that a weak ruler may end up attempting to circumvent restrictions that can result in worrisome activity. I don't think that is really up for debate. The question is whether or not he'll succeed in that regard. Look at what happened. Trump was not able to get funding for his wall. And so an entire election campaign, this is a referendum on my immigration policy.
If you want more caravans, if you want more crime, vote Democrat tomorrow.
And he lost catastrophically. Now, the warnings going into those elections were twofold. One, Trump could suspend the elections. We might not have midterms elections. This was a prediction that was repeatedly made throughout the last 2 years. And then the warning was they won't honor the results of the election. Well, lo and behold, they did. So now we have a Democratic House. So Trump wants to up the ante again. He engaged in strong-arm tactics. He prompts a shutdown. And lo and behold, it doesn't work. So now he is going to come out with $1.3 billion, and now he ups it again with his state of emergency. First, the House of Representatives votes to rebuke him. The Senate may rebuke him. And Trump will then have to veto a bill. You do see a kind of escalation, but what you don't see is Trump actually being able to succeed in gaining his wishes. Weak rulers may attempt authoritarian measures, but precisely because they are weak, they will probably fail.
And the utter dismantling of the regulatory apparatus of government, the damage to our alliances, the cozying up to dictators, those are not actual damage?
So I think we have to be really careful here. The question that's on the table was not, can Trump and our Republicans doing damage, but whether or not it's authoritarian. So let's take that apart a little bit. The regulatory apparatus, there is no doubt that Trump is seeking to dismantle the regulatory apparatus. It just so happens to be that that is a long-standing Republican Party principle that began under Ronald Reagan and got increasing traction under his regime, and then also, I should say, under Bill Clinton's regime, and then George W. Bush. If we want to start calling something like that authoritarian, we're really moving in a very different direction, because deregulation and gutting the regulatory apparatus has been a hallmark of what we call neoliberalism for a very long time. In terms of damage to alliances, Trump from the get-go said he was going to pull out of NATO. It actually hasn't really happened. And in terms of cozying up to dictators, of course, we have the problem that there's nothing particularly new about American presidents cozying up to dictators, whether it's Saudi Arabia or Ronald Reagan praising Rios Montt, the Guatemalan dictator who presided over a regime of genocide. These are all longstanding problems within the American polity. And here's where the question of historical memory, I think, becomes very important. If we want to recode all of that as authoritarianism, or even, frankly, the attempt by a president to evade the will of Congress by using his executive branch authority, I mean, Obama had to do that all the time. We're really running the risk of, you know, everything becomes under the rubric of authoritarianism, including a lot of previous presidents. So we either go down that road, or then we become partisans and say, no, that was different. Trump is the only one. And I think this is where this Historivox complex gets us into kind of trouble. We either become very partisan and we just deploy categories only against the presidents we don't like, or we become kind of homogenizers and everything, all presidents are authoritarian because they've done a lot of these things.
Are you suggesting, Corey, and I want to get to the nub of this, that I simply submit my resignation now and apologize to my audience? Or would you say that I have a chance at redemption?
I love your show. That's all I'm going to say. And in all seriousness, I think the issues that have been raised by the Trump regime are really profound ones. And I think we've had a long overdue conversation on this question of authoritarianism. I suspect that in the remaining 2 years of what I hope is his first and only term, that we're going to see even more signs of weakness. And I hope what we do is not just junk the authoritarian discussion and say, okay, you know, now we're on to weakness, but try to be a little bit, again, mindful of the past, not only of what has happened in the past, but also how we have thought about the past versus how we think about the present, and not just junk one frame for another, but ask ourselves, is there some kind of a frame that helps us make sense of the ongoingness of these elements?
If this is a question of framing, how should we frame the current moment?
A couple of elements. Number one, rather than representing a break with the right, Trump represents an intensification of longstanding tendencies on the right, particularly with respect to questions about race. Number two, that intensification on the right goes hand in hand with what I think is a steady weakening of the conservative movement. In other words, rather than seeing Trump and conservatism as embodying a new ascendancy, I think that a proper historical reckoning would see everything about the Trump regime as a sign of growing weakness. I sometimes use an analogy from the past. If you were in Britain in the second half of the 1970s, on the left, there were a group of Trotskyists, and they became increasingly militant. If you were to focus on them, you would think the story of the second half of Britain in the 1970s is the rise of the militant tendency. But of course, we know the real story was the rise of Thatcherism. A group can become more radicalized, more extreme, precisely in concert with its marginalization. And all the signs are that compared to somebody like Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan, or George W. Bush, Trump is presiding over a very weak Republican presidency. not because the presidency is weak, but I would argue because the conservative movement and the Republican Party have gotten weaker. And that has gone hand in hand with a kind of intensification of certain extreme tendencies on the Republican Party.
What you seem to be describing is a supernova burning brightly with a tremendous amount of destructive energy because it's a dying star.
I think that's perfectly put.
Corey, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Corey Robin is a professor of political science at Brooklyn College and the CUNY Graduate Center. His New York Magazine post is called, "Why Has It Taken Us So Long to See Trump's Weakness?"
If you're the kind of person who gets a chill when the president fires up an arena of believers, you ain't heard nothing yet.
This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. And that's the sound of the Stonemasons March of the German-American Bund. Founded in 1936, it had approximately 25,000 members and 70 chapters around the country. While the Nazis were building concentration camps, the Bund held pro-Hitler retreats and summer camps. February 20th marked the 80th anniversary of the Bund's most notorious event, when 20,000 of its members gathered at Madison Square Garden for a, quote, pro-American rally featuring speeches and performances staged in front of a 30-foot-high portrait of George Washington. The rally is the subject of the Oscar-nominated documentary short, or should I say, very short, A Night at the Garden by filmmaker Marshall Curry. Marshall, welcome to OTM.
Thanks so much for having me.
Can we start with the 30-second ad for your documentary? Because it's had a media moment of its own.
Well, it was not exactly what we expected. We decided to put an ad on Sean Hannity's show. And so we
stop there. Why?
Well, we felt like the film was something that people who watched Sean Hannity's show needed to see. The film is about a rally in Madison Square Garden. It is, to me, a cautionary tale about the tactics that demagogues use to whip up Americans against each other. And when I saw the footage for the first time, I was really struck by how similar it seemed to Trump rallies today.
Mm-hmm.
Not to say that Donald Trump is a Nazi, but I do think that he uses similar tactics to the ones that we see in the film.
So, you wanted to put it on Hannity, and then what happened?
So we edited an ad that is literally just footage from the rally that night, historical footage, and a couple of pull quotes from press reports about the film. And the CEO of Fox News stepped in and personally rejected the ad from airing on Hannity's show.
Fox says it just found the imagery too disturbing.
Right. But reporters began surfacing other examples of Fox News advertisements that included imagery that was at least as disturbing. Dinesh D'Souza's quote-unquote documentary had Nazi imagery that was aired on Fox.
That suggested that the left were Nazis.
That's right.
Yeah.
And an ad on Tucker Carlson's show showed Nazi imagery. So the reason that they were giving was on its face untrue.
So why do you think Fox rejected it?
I think that they thought it was a little close to home. The Washington Post had written a story when we first were placing the ad, and that story connected the dots between what was happening in 1939 and what I think is happening today. And I'm sure that that story made its way up the chain of command at Fox News, and they decided that they didn't want their audience to see this moment of history for some reason or other.
How did you come upon it?
I have a friend who was writing a screenplay that takes place in New York in 1939, and we were at dinner, and he asked me whether I knew about the rally, and I didn't, and in fact, I didn't even believe him until I got home that night and looked it up and discovered that there had been clips of that night, and so I got an archival researcher who's a friend to start digging around, and he found some in the National Archive and some in UCLA's archive and some in Grinberg Archive and other places there were fragments that were in all these different places, but nobody had ever pulled it together.
You decided to develop the film even before the 2017 Charlottesville rally, where somebody died when a white supremacist drove into a crowd.
Right. When I saw the footage, it struck me as Trumpian. And then Charlottesville happened. And suddenly I realized that it wasn't even just a metaphor for Trumpism. There was an element of that world that was actually Nazi. And so I called Laura Poitras and Charlotte Cook, who run Field of Vision, and we finished the film and released it quickly as we could.
The national leader of the Bund, Fritz Kuhn, began his speech at the event by slamming the press with anti-Semitic slurs.
I'm sure I do not come before you tonight as a complete stranger. You all have heard of me through the Jewish-controlled press as a creature with horns, a cloven hoof, and a long tail.
So we know Kuhn's speech at the Bund was a lot longer than the few minutes featured in your film. In fact, WNYC has all 2 hours of it. How did you choose which parts of the event to include?
I was told that this is the shortest Oscar nominee in 50 years. I wanted to cut the event down to the bone and just show the essence of everything that happened for 2 reasons. One is I didn't feel like we needed to give Fritz Kuhn a long platform. And also, I felt like if we could just get the essence of what was happening that night, a lot more people would share a 7-minute film on Facebook and Twitter than would watch a 30 or 40 minute film. I decided to edit it as if it were a Verite documentary where there is no narration, and instead the audience is just dropped into this world to puzzle it out. And there are a number of head fakes built into it. You know, the movie's called A Night at the Garden, so you might think it's going to be about a basketball game. The marquee outside describes the event as a pro-America rally, so you might think that it's just going to be a typical patriotic event. The film begins with a rally that is full of American flags and the icons of America, a huge portrait of George Washington that has swastikas on either side. The crowd comes in and they sing the Star Spangled Banner and they recite the Pledge of Allegiance.
One nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
And you get inside and you see, and are those people doing the Nazi salute? I was just trying to get the pieces that would pull us into the story and provoke shock and also a sense of reflection about what those events tell us about today.
It also shows us how the emblems of patriotism are so easily appropriated. I mean, even if patriotism means freedom of speech, you can still use the emblems and then excoriate the press. There is one element that didn't make it into your film that was particularly pointed to me, and that was the sense of victimhood that was also appropriated by here the German-American Bund.
I heard sometimes the question, why don't you go back to Germany if you don't like the way we run things here? And I ask, who is we? Is the communists, the Jews, the 100%ers, the socialists, the Democrats, the Republicans, the Methodists or the Baptists, or the acquisitors for the administration? Are not the American citizens of German extraction included in the we's that have a right to run things here?
He basically goes on to say that German Americans are the most persecuted minority.
The laughter and the jeering that comes from his audiences was also familiar and upsetting. In the background of one of the shots, I noticed a little boy who sort of jumps up and down and rubs his hands excitedly and does a little jig as Isidore Greenbaum is being beaten up and thrown off stage. It was a warning about human nature. You know, if we're honest, there is a part of us that is thrilled by being part of a mob, and we need to be aware of that if we want to diffuse that mob mentality that sometimes overtakes politics.
Here are the police.
we see Isadore Greenbaum storm the stage. What's his story?
He was a Jewish plumber's assistant from Brooklyn who went down to the rally that night to see what was going on and was so outraged by what he saw on stage that he ran out to try to say something and was grabbed by the, I guess, stormtroopers that were on stage, and they beat him up, rip off his pants, and throw him off stage. He was arrested that night for disturbing the peace and fined $25 the next day. In the New York Times reports, they said that the magistrate who was sentencing him said to him, "Don't you realize that someone could have been hurt by what you were doing out on stage?" And Greenbaum said to him, "Don't you realize that someone's going to be hurt from what was being said on that stage?"
When you were doing your research, you were reading some of the coverage of the event at the time, right?
And it's so interesting to see how contemporary some of that coverage seems. One big debate was whether a group like the Bund should be allowed to have a rally in Madison Square Garden. There were many people who felt that they shouldn't, though leading Jewish groups at the time and many others felt the difference between the United States and fascist Germany is that in the United States, even idiots are allowed to say what they think. And of course, there were other people who said, sure, let them say what they think, but don't give them Madison Square Garden. That brings instantly to mind debates on college campuses and places like that where we're having this exact same argument 80 years later.
There's a history to the German-American Bund. It was a presence in various parts of the country, especially Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and New York. So what happened to the organization after the rally?
Well, once German soldiers started killing American soldiers, America's tolerance for this kind of ideology disappeared very, very quickly. Fritz Kuhn, the speaker during the rally, he was arrested for embezzling money and actually had his citizenship stripped from him and was deported to Germany after World War II, where he died.
You were talking about how the tolerance for these kinds of views waned after America joined the war, but let's talk about that tolerance. You had people like Henry Ford and Lindbergh and the notorious Father Coughlin inveighing against the Jews or standing in solidarity with Germany.
My dear friends, we are Christian insofar as we believe in Christ's principle of love your neighbor as yourself, and with that principle, I challenge every Jew in this nation to tell me that he does not believe in it.
You know, this was not a majority point of view in America by any stretch, but it was considered a legitimate point of view. These were the kind of people who probably would have been booked on cable news to offer the other side to the Nazi question if they had been around today. It was an opinion held by many public leaders, including Father Coughlin, whose show was carried into the homes of 30 million Americans.
And you think we've largely erased that part of our history?
But of course, the ideology didn't completely go away. And if you don't know that any Americans ever supported Nazi ideology, it's easy to assume that there's no threat today. When you see this footage and you see the spell that these kinds of people can cast, the reason that we avoided falling into the trap is because of people's hard work pushing back on those ideas.
Press magnate William Randolph Hearst declared, "Whenever you hear a prominent American called a fascist, you can usually make up your mind that the man is simply a loyal citizen who stands for Americanism."
I think one of the reasons that the Bund did not catch on even more is because of the Germanness of it. When you hear the leader Fritz Kuhn talking, he has a German accent. There were a lot of German cultural trappings in the Bund, and I think that probably kept many non-Germans from embracing it. But that is part of what frightens me so much about the current super right-wing part of America. They understand American culture very well, how to use memes and the internet and sarcasm. There's a famous line that I'm paraphrasing. It's essentially, when fascism comes to America, it won't have a German accent and it won't use swastikas. It will be called Americanism.
Marshall, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Marshall Curry is the director of the documentary short film A Night at the Garden, which you can see at anightatthegarden.com.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Michael Loewinger, Leia Fetter, John Hanrahan, and Astra Chaturvedi. We had more help from Zandra Ellen, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our executive producer is Katya Rogers. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Sam Baer and Josh Hahn.
On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Overbrook Foundation and the listeners of WNYC Radio.